We'd like to welcome everyone to tonight's teleseminar with Karen Scholl. We've got several questions that have been sent in from our listeners, and the topics for this evening's teleseminar are rolling, weaving, a vicious pony update, a bracy mare, and Karen's comments on a bit or use a rope halter. First topic is rolling. I have a question about how to stop a horse from rolling. When I bought my Fjord mare 6 years ago, she rolled with me 3 times the first year. She gives no warning, no pawing, actually does not even stop her walking. She just drops a shoulder and rolls. Once she rolled when she was leading, and the other 2 times when she was following. 2 times were on wood, chippy surfaces, and once was at the beach. So whenever we crossed sand or soft footing, I would talk to her and do little S-turns to remind her I was up there. Nothing else happened for 3 years. Then one trail ride, she started to roll again. But I realized it and hit her ears with my crop. She lurched back up, and I was still on. She's a very steady and quiet mount otherwise, which is what I need to know now that I am 60. How can I get her not to roll at all, ever? Thank you. Valerie in Connecticut.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting thing when we're talking about behaviors with horses is, you know, there's natural behaviors or natural tendencies, and then there's also learned behaviors. So rolling is a very natural behavior for all horses. You know, horses out in the wild, they roll, they want to get dirty. Everybody knows, you know, if you want to teach a horse to lay down, just give them a bath first. You know, they want to get that dirt onto their body. It protects their skin. It protects them from sun, bugs, all kinds of things. So it's a very natural thing for horses to want to do that. Some individuals roll more than others. They have more of a tendency to, you know, be kind of scratchy, you know, just like people or dogs, you know, things like that. So what it sounds like is that the horse makes a decision in her mind and then just goes ahead and does it. And one of the things to think about in the big picture is when you develop a partnership with a horse, I like to look at that partnership as one individual has, you know, 51%. The other individual has 49%. And what the horse should learn to do, conditioned to do in all of the things, you know, whether it's leading them at feeding time, loading a trailer, kind of in any environment, is that horse following the direction and the lead from you. So we don't always realize that. You know, I observe people when they're, you know, leading the horse, you know, who's leading whom. So it's in those little decisions, in our lack of response or even awareness maybe in the situation, that we don't realize that the horse is being conditioned through our lack of response to be making those kinds of decisions. So that's kind of number one in a big picture kind of a scenario. Just develop your ultimate awareness of, sorry, I'm getting some background noise. I don't know if everybody's muted. Mark, can you, well, we muted everybody. Just, anyway.
If you joined us late, can you please hit *6 on your phone and mute your phone from our conference?
Yeah, sometimes
please.
It's just a phone bumping around on a desk or whatever that we don't realize the sounds come. The phones are so good nowadays, we don't realize it picks up everything. So usually when a horse starts to roll, you already talked about this, there will be indications that they're thinking about it. And you already know you have that awareness because you're aware now that when the surface that you're walking on changes, that you start doing things to keep the horse mentally engaged. I mean, she knows you're up there. It's not about reminding her that you're up there. What it is it's reminding her that you're making the decisions, okay? So, you know, sometimes it is about, you know, recognizing when a horse does need to roll and then creating a cue for asking the horse to roll, not necessarily when you're on the horse, but, you know, like after a nice bath or a rinse off or something like that, take them to a sandy area, create a cue that says, now I'm asking you to roll. So it's, the horse is going to roll. you know. So sometimes it's about creating a cue for when you want the behavior. Then in absence of the cue, the horse starts to recognize that you didn't invite them to roll, okay? So that's something that can be helpful as well. The other piece is that when they do roll, and I have a horse, personal horse, that he can just drop like a rock and just be down with you, same kind of thing. No warning, no anything. Usually most horses will at least put their nose down to the ground before they start to roll. But it can be pretty quick, and the horse that I have, Deb, doesn't even do that. He just, his knees kind of go down first, you know, his knees in the front, and boy, his shoulders hitting the ground really pretty fast. So what I had to do is kind of after the fact or after the behavior happens, because I can't always catch it, is that the consequence of the action had to change. Because I, you know, could kind of catch it and I could kind of work around it and not go through the soft, sandy spots. You know, I was always having to kind of watch out for these things because it is a very dangerous thing for a horse, you know, to do with you on them. So what I finally did, and knock on wood, you know, he has not done it since, but finally when he rolled, and I wasn't on him at the time, but he rolled while I was ponying him, and we were at a trot. So I'm riding one horse, ponying him, we're at a long trot, and he just, you know, dropped to the ground, about pulled me off my horse, got around, and, you know, luckily I had an extension of my arm with me, and it's at the hindquarters. When you put pressure at the hindquarters, that causes a horse, like when the horse's head starts to go down in a position for a roll, if you can put pressure on the hindquarters, okay, it sounded like your response in that last time was to put pressure at the ears, which can kind of work but it wasn't really necessary, and also the horse can get defensive about the ears. You know, we're trying not to put any pressure or anything around the head or the ears, especially, you know, and it's hard not to do, you know, when a horse is rolling with you. I mean, any body part that you can reach, you know, it's something that's going to cause that horse to, you know, jump back up, you know, and that kept you safe, and that's what worked. But if you can talk to the hindquarters, and we've talked about, you know, if you can catch it, that's great, but talk to the hindquarters. So, you know, when I'm standing in front of an audience, you know, I give that example. When the head goes down, this applies for horses grazing when you don't want them to, you know, sniffing the ground, that kind of a thing. I give the example of when we lean over in front of our honeys, their tendency is to, you know, give us a loving little pat on the behind, and the first thing that happens is our head pops back up, and we turn around and go, hey, quit that, I hate when you do that. So you can do that with horses for behaviors like rolling or grazing, anything where you need the head to come up, put rhythmic pressure, not one big whack, but start lightly and continuously get firmer and firmer until the head comes up and immediately release the pressure. Okay? So back to Deb, the last time he went down just so unexpectedly, just like you're describing, I happened to be riding with an extension, you know, a rope, and I was able to ride over to him, and he's having a big old roll by this time. I get turned around back to him. This is all within seconds, and I put enough pressure on his hindquarters that he finally said, you know what, rolling does not equal pleasure. So it's not a punishment kind of a thing. It's something that it has to be enough consequence for him to change his mind about rolling, okay? And also I started creating, you know, a stronger cue and more frequently to when I do want him to roll, I invite it. And he'll hesitate and say, really, you know, really? And I'll go, yes, I want it now when I'm ready. Okay, and those pieces, I mean, this is a full-time deal. You know, we have horses for a hobby. We have, you know, dogs because we love them in our family. We have kids, you know, and we love having these individuals in our lives. But the ongoing interaction and shaping of behavior is an awareness, number one, you know, full-time awareness and a full-time willingness, you know, to respond to every behavior that they happen to throw at us. But Roland is one that is definitely a full-time job. And you know, as with all the behaviors, but that one especially, because you can go along in a horse that just says, man, I've got a roll. You haven't asked me, you know, to roll in a long time. You know, you have to keep recognizing that that is a horse's, you know, need to do that. And then some, like I said, some individuals stronger than others. So it's important to recognize that and create a cue for when you do want that for them. But then if they do it without asking you, you know, sometimes you just have to come in with enough pressure, enough consequence to change that horse's mind about that. So that, you know, next time they have that thought, they go, no, you know what, Karen will let me know when I can roll. Okay? So it's a challenging one. You know, it is a very challenging one. But our tendency when a horse starts to roll or do anything is we tend to hold on to the reins. We tend to try to prevent the head from going down. And when you think about it, you know, a horse's head and neck are so powerful. And it's the release that teaches that, you know, we can't hold that head up. I mean, rooting on the bit is one of the most common, you know, behaviors. You see little kids' horses just about pull a little kid off the saddle. You know, they can pull the reins out of our hands so hard. So, you know, we don't want to get into that pattern or that kind of habit because that makes riding uncomfortable for the horse. You know, we're always keeping them reined in all the time to try to prevent these behaviors. Instead of that, you know, try thinking of these kinds of strategies, you know, that you can draw from and then, you know, be ready for it, number one, and then just develop those kinds of habits, you know, in everything that you do so that you do respond, you know, with as near close to, or I want to say perfect timing, because there's no such thing, but the ideal timing to affect that influence and change in the horse's mind. That's what you're ultimately going for. How do I change this horse's mind about making that independent decision to roll when I'm not aware of it at all? Okay, so it's kind of a big answer for, you know, what seems like a, you know, a simple piece of a technique, but I feel it's important that you understand the big picture of that behavior. So that you can look at it in a lot of different ways and have more approaches to draw from with that particular horse in those situations. So good luck with that.
Well, thanks for that, Karen. That sounds like a really good technique that Valerie should be happy to have in her horseman's toolbox when she goes out on the trail again. The next topic tonight is weaving. Hi, Karen. I've talked to you at Equine Affair in Ohio, and I have several of your DVDs, which have helped me tremendously. My question is what to do about a horse that weaves in his stall and also in our slant load trailer. I have an 11-year-old Arabian gelding that I rescued 6 years ago. He was kept in a small stall for the first 5 years of his life with very little turnout time. He was a stallion when I got him, so I gelded him immediately. Now, 6 years later, he has excellent ground manners, is great on the trails, and loads in our trailer. He's always willing to learn and learns quickly. Now that we are trailering him, I'm concerned about long-distance hauling and his weaving. I want to take him to our property, but it's about an 8 or 9 hour trip. He's out in the field 24/7 except in winter when we call him only at night. Thank you for any help that you may have, Sandy in Ohio.
So I'm confused there, Mark. Is he weaving in the stall now?
Sounds like he weaves in the trailer. She didn't say if he's still weaving in the stall on winter night.
Okay. You know, obviously weaving is, you know, what's called a displaced behavior. A displaced behavior means you know, the horse is designed to be moving and in motion. You know, they only sleep about 4 hours a day, usually only 20 to 40 minutes at a time. Some horses more, some less. But horses that are confined to stalls, and especially, you know, it's really sad, you know, to think of the life of a lot of stallions. Not all, certainly. But, you know, stallions cannot be turned out with other horses safely because they have different behaviors. People aren't comfortable with that a lot of times. So it's very traditional to have stallions in basically, you know, confinement. You know, they're in isolated confinement. So they get displaced behavior because here's this stallion with raging testosterone designed by nature to breed mares. They get very little turnout, and they become neurotic. You know, so what they do, because they don't have the natural motion and movement available to them, they create it through this pattern of weaving. And if someone has not seen this pattern, basically they rock side to side in a small area. Usually their head is over, you know, over a barn door, their stall door. You know, it's usually solid on the bottom, and they'll have their head out of that, you know, head and neck, and they'll just rock side to side, side to side, side to side. And people will walk by and go, oh, he's doing it, isn't that funny? And, you know, and they laugh and go, oh, look, he's dancing. And people create all these kind of cutenesses around it. But it's really this horse just basically kind of mentally checking out and going into this motion. It's just, it's a neurosis. It's a displaced behavior. So the ideal thing is to have a horse that never experiences the kind of confinement that would cause, you know, that kind of behavior. And don't forget, you have naked mares being led past him all the time too. So here's this poor stallion, like, you know, his mind is just, you know, he literally becomes out of his mind. What happens then is it sounds like conditions change. You know, the stallion became a gelding. The gelding now is turned out most of the day, brought in at night. But those habits, those physiological habits, are wired in that horse's neural pathways. And so you can do a lot of things to alleviate that, and you're doing a lot of them already. Hopefully he's turned out with other horses. That's a really nice thing for horses. They're herd animals. They're designed by nature to be around other horses. And it's interesting. They get another individual to interact with. The other thing is to have every kind of obstacle, toy, uneven ground, you know, hills for them to go over. You know, I've been to places and they'll take, you know, trees that they had to clear out and put kind of big logs out there, and the horses can get their teeth on them and play with them, jump over them. Some folks had these just, you know, they took their, you know, old trees and set them up as these jumps, and the horses didn't have to jump the jumps. It wasn't set up like in a, you know, a lane or something where they get trapped in the lane and have to jump it. These horses would freely, you know, go for a run around the pasture and aim and jump these, you know, nice good-sized jumps, you know, something that's interesting to them. So many times, you know, we put horses out, you know, on flat ground, you know, just very little undulating terrain or change of terrain. You know, it's all so predictable and so ordinary. And they don't even have anything to rub against. You know, horses are very scratchy against trees. They chew on trees. You know, there's stuff going on. So a lot of times we may have the horse turned out, but there's nothing really of interest out there. And I don't mean just like, you know, a jolly ball and a, you know, old milk crate, you know, with a rock in it to rattle. You know, I mean, put so many things, you know, certain horses are so highly playful. You know, they want things to interact with. They'll, you know, pick things up. They'll carry things around. They'll do all kinds of, you know, goofy, crazy things. And the more things you put out there, and change them up, you know, take some things away, put them away for a while, put something different out there. I have a 6-month-old puppy right now, and I have to take toys and put them away out of sight for a while, bring them out, you know, a few weeks later, whatever, and she goes, oh, new toy, and off we go again. But if I leave them out too long, she kind of sits there and says, you know, nothing. I've got nothing to do with that thing, and it'll sit there forever. The other thing is, you know, think about what can mentally challenge the horse. You know, are there some things that you can set up just in ordinary scenarios, like, you know, take a tarp and put it up over a gate. You know, if you have a gate that has an overhead support, you know, can the horse learn to go under a tarp or, you know, through some, you know, swimming pool obstacles or step over a, you know, a old you know, mattress, you know, I mean, things like that. Not something that they can tear up and make it dangerous and get wire wrapped around the legs, you know, and things like that. But, you know, can you have some things that the horse to, you know, go down the, you know, lane that they go down 100 times a day, can you put something out there and say, okay, now you're going to go over a tarp when you do this? So, you know, it's wonderful that you have the DVDs and you have the basic form of communication. You're developing a wonderful relationship with your horse. Now it's important to challenge it. You know, now it's important to go, you know, hey, can you back up into the trailer? You know, can I have you go in the trailer at liberty? You know, so can I sit on top of the trailer and have you go in underneath my feet? Can I, you know, have you go around and ride around the kids while they're on the trampoline? You know, I hope you're getting the idea that just the sky's the limit. And the more challenged, the more mentally challenged your horse can be, the less they have the urge to weave, you know, back and forth. So, but it may be a pattern of behavior that your horse just is so hardwired into. It sounds like a pretty extreme case that you got him from. It may be that they're so hardwired into that it may be something that they do, you know, for their whole life. So I do know horses that, you know, it becomes a very strong part of their psyche. So, you know, you can do all the stimulation in the world and, you know, get them mentally exhausted, mentally satisfied. And then these behaviors, you know, start to diminish. And some horses, it eventually completely goes away. So, you know, there are other products in the market, and I'm sure you've seen them around, you know, and I've brought this up in teleseminars before and talked about it in presentations, but there are shock collars for horses. And I don't, you know, if the horse's life is in danger or, you know, something, I try not to be absolute. I want to remain open-minded and possibilities. But I haven't found that when the person really puts the imagination and the effort and the creativity in an ongoing basis, that the horse has ever got to a point of needing that, okay? But I have to, you know, I feel obligated to say that because, number one, people go, well, you know, Karen must not know about shock collars. You know, it's, believe me, I try to find every possible, you know, option to shape a horse's behavior to keep, you know, horses and people safe and enjoying their interaction with each other. So I'm open-minded. I consider myself extremely open-minded to possibilities. I just haven't found where a horse's behavior has not been able to reshape, you know, to get to a resort, you know, of having to use a device like that. I have seen horses that I've considered it on, but that was an individual that was actually doing a behavior called self-mutilation. He was so frustrated, same scenario, growing up as a stallion in, you know, confined area, and he developed the pattern of behavior that at feeding time he had so much angst and anxiety that he would come down to his chest and pull the skin and eventually the flesh away from his chest, okay? So that's pretty extreme behavior. Weaving doesn't sound so bad when you hear about behavior like that, but just know that that is how critical it is for horses to have their needs met and to feel mentally, emotionally, and physically satisfied in the environment that we keep them in to the best of our ability. We're not always able, you know, for the conditions that we're in to be able to satisfy them fully, but that's our commitment. That's what we want to strive to do, okay? So hopefully that gives you some ideas in doing that. As far as hauling in the horse trailer, you know, make sure the environment is safe. One of the things that happens when horses weave extensively, and you probably already found this inside the stall, is they'll get a certain spot and the ground will kind of dig out and they'll kind of create little ramps on the outside and they'll kind of use that to push off of because they really like to, when they get into weaving, they get a really strong push. It's actually an endorphin release. So causes an endorphin release. So when you get into a trailer, make sure that your mats are nice and heavy. Okay, I see people with horse trailers and they put thin mats in there all the time. You want your mats to be, you know, heavy enough that a horse, isn't going to just move and have that mat slip around on that wood. You almost want it to be that if the wood underneath had a problem, that mat would be so heavy and firm that the horse, you know, would almost not even know it. Okay, that's, you want that protective barrier of a mat, you know, inside the floor of the trailer. And other than that, you know, try to find a moment when your horse is not weaving to bring them out of their stall or feed them or take them out of the trailer. That's another piece we don't realize when we're shaping behavior. So if we walk up to the stall and the horse is weaving, okay, and this is where I think it really starts sometimes, is the horse is confined, the horse is weaving, you know, feeding time is on a regular schedule, nobody's, you know, a lot of times people don't take the time to just stop and wait for the horse to not weave before they throw the feed, okay, it goes for pinning of the ears and, you know, banging on the rail, things like that. You need to wait for a moment when the horse's behavior is something you want to see more of before down for the horse. Okay, so that's another piece. And it only has to be for a half a second. It doesn't have to be like, okay, you don't weave for 10 minutes. That's too big of a gap for a lot of horses. If you can take just a moment when they stop the behavior and then you're reinforcing just the standing there looking at you behavior with ears forward, okay? Same thing with the horse trailer. You know, if a horse is in there, they're weaving side to side or pawing, banging on the trailer or fussing, it doesn't hurt them really. Now, horses will try to convince you otherwise, but it really doesn't hurt a horse to stay in the trailer. You know, we get in the habit of going, oh, he doesn't trailer well, and the horse is upset, and they're frantic, and they're pawing, and then, you know, we get to where we're going, and we jump out and scurry back there and get him out really fast, okay? Well, what have we done there? What we've really done is the horse is, you know, expressing the behavior, and then we bring them out, we inadvertently reinforce the behavior. We don't realize that we're doing that, okay? So, you know, when the horse is weaving, just try to wait. It's sometimes the hardest thing for humans to do. Just wait. And when the horse kind of stands there for a minute and says, you know, hey, what are you guys doing? Then step in there and ask them to come back out, okay? So pretty soon the horse starts to learn, what behavior do I need to be displaying when, you know, somebody, you know, throws feed to me, brings me out of the trailer, you know, all these kinds of things. So that's why I talk about, you know, we are shaping behavior. One of my favorite things to do at the big expos or to an audience is I'll ask, you know, for a show of hands, who's a horse trainer? And, you know, you get a few people raise their hands, and I'll say, okay, let me rephrase that. Do you agree that our interaction with horses shapes the behavior of the horse that we're interacting with? Everybody thinks about it and says, well, yeah. And I said, okay, raise your hand if you are a horse trainer. And everybody raises their hand and says, oh, you know, we that's what we're really doing. So that's why I like doing the teleseminars, to give people just a little different perspective in how we're shaping horses' behavior. You have an existing behavior. It's oftentimes more of a challenge to even get back to zero, okay, because the horse has an existing behavior. But it's the same principle as if you're shaping new behavior and the horse doesn't have any patterns at all. So, you know, just try to keep that awareness and see if you can't just chip away at it. Again, as with any of these behaviors, it's about, you know, it didn't start in one day. You know, it's been going on for years and years and years. So if you just make that commitment and say, every opportunity I get, I'm just going to keep chipping away at this, and you'll find that your efforts will be greatly rewarded. You'll have a much happier horse. You'll be more mentally stimulated, more satisfied in his daily activity. And I think it's just the best feeling in the world to know that you did something for this horse that, you know, certainly deserves the effort that you're already putting into it, and sounds like, you know, you want to continue as well. So good luck. I'd love to hear back, you know, how it's going for him and you.
That's great. And yes, Andy, we'd love to hear back from you on how you're doing with this. So, thank you.
Okay.
The next one is actually an update. It's a Vicious Pony update.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Thanks, Karen, for your response in June regarding the Vicious Pony, who was lovely with people but not other horses. I have another 38-year-old pony here on my farm and a Shetland that I worried about. I considered all the facts and decided the wicked pony would someday, when my back was turned, harm my ponies and maybe cost me a lot of money in vet bills one way or the other. Fortunately, I had the pony here on trial, and I decided to just return him to his owners. Many thanks for your time and response to my question in June, Judy.
Good. You know, that I think is one of the most difficult decisions to make, because we believe that, you know, we want to help these animals. You know, we genuinely do. And, you know, but we have to keep in mind that, you know, us incurring a serious injury, it doesn't help the animals, because then we don't have the ability to, you know, earn a paycheck, take care of our family. You know, we have to, as much as we care for these animals, you know, I tell people the only thing I love more than horses is people. So people are always number one in my answers. You know, the horses, bless their hearts, you know, and you just don't know. I mean, you don't, people think, well, if I give up on this horse, who's going to try? And you don't know. You know, the next person might come along and, you know, and be an even better option, environment, situation, skill level, you know, for that pony. And we may, you know, keep it out of a sense of obligation and rob that animal of an even better situation, a better option, you know, down the road. So it's a hard decision. I really want to commend you on making an honest assessment of the situation and making that very, very difficult decision. So, and say a prayer for the pony and go, you know, hope that, you know, trust that, you know, God certainly takes care of the animals. That is for sure. So I want to commend you on making a very difficult decision. But I'm really glad that you're still around to, you know, tell me about it. And that's the truth. If you will get one thing from the teleseminars from me, and that is, you know, the truth, you know, as I see it, you know, in my opinion. Okay.
Well, thanks very much. This next one is a Bracey mare. I have a lovely 6-year-old paint mare who's very inexperienced and knows very little under saddle. Her groundwork is coming along nicely, but she's bracy and stiff laterally under saddle. She will give to the halter. I prefer no bit, but she's not light yet. Also, sometimes when asked to turn, she'll toss her head and threaten to rear. She's fun, but stubborn. I have 3 well-trained horses, but they were easier to train than her. She used to rear online, but no more. How do I let her to be less, or get her to be less bracy under saddle, and also to make sure she doesn't rear while I'm riding her? Thanks, Lynn in South Carolina.
Well, you know, when you're assessing a situation, a behavior like that, you need to look kind of in 3 categories. It's either mental, emotional, or physical. And it seems like, it may not be, but I would definitely try to assess the physical in the situation. Horses can have limitations, and when I hear the word stubborn, you know, I've not met a horse that's truly stubborn, okay? So let me define that a little bit. I'll ask an audience, you know, raise your hand if you've ever felt your horse was stubborn. Lots of hands go up. So it's a common thing to think, well, the horse is stubborn. What's really happening is the horse is trying to tell us something, okay? And the horse will go, well, I'll keep trying to tell you, you know. And some horses, you know, they'll have a physical limitation, and they'll try to tell us, and we don't necessarily notice it, and they'll go through it. Some horses, and especially in my observation, mares, they're not very forgiving know, geldings, they kind of go along and go, okay, well, you know, here we go. But mares, you know, they, I don't want to say it's a different sensitivity level, they expect more from us. And so sometimes what will happen is, you know, we'll get a mare and they just won't tolerate some of the things, you know, that other horses will. So they're great teachers for us. You can look at it that way. But it sounds like if the horse on the ground is laterally bending, everything is soft, your hands are, you know, fair but firm, and the horse is giving, moving the hindquarters, you're doing all of your, you know, ground skills, and everything is really soft and really light, then when you're sitting in the saddle and that changes, to me that's an indication that they're feeling restricted in their physiology. So in their back is a really common place for a horse to feel restricted. Another place that it can be, but usually you'll see it on the ground also, is in their teeth. You know, horses' teeth grow their entire lives. And I don't know the age of the horse. You know, sometimes it can be that they're losing some of their caps and their teeth get uncomfortable when they go to turn. But when a horse's head turns, their lower jaw, the way it's designed to grind their food, it moves side to side. It's how the teeth grind. And so it's not just about getting points on the molars. It's about making sure that the teeth are level. So you may want to, I have seen horses that under saddle, they just can't find a way to get comfortable when they're turning. And this kind of sounds like what's going on with this mare, is that she's not comfortable in these. A horse doesn't want to rear, okay? They don't want to do that. You know, horse, it's too much effort, really. I've seen horses develop a pattern of behavior for rearing, but it's not something that they really want to do. So she's really trying to tell you that there's something, you know, not right. So it's either I check something in their back, check something in their teeth, you know, make sure that everything can turn, because if their head goes to turn and their jaw's locked up, say they have a ramp or a, you know, a wave or some kind of shape to the teeth that isn't allowing that lower jaw to move freely side to side, just that little bit of a turn causes their entire body to lock up. And it can be, you know, pain in their TMJ, you know, things like that. But that kind of what you're describing there, I kind of get the indication that there's something in the physiology if you're not seeing it in the ground skills. That's a big part of doing the ground skills, is you're checking out the horse's physiology. The other thing to check on is the strength of the horse's back. If the horse is a young horse, they don't have a lot of muscle development yet on their back. So doing lots of top-line strengthening, there's lots of exercises that you can do, that you can get DVDs on and see on the internet, that will strengthen the horse's top line so that they're better able to support the weight of the saddle and weight of the rider. Okay, so, you know, it's something that a horse develops. So I've seen horses, like when I've started young horses, they're sitting there going, now I have to do everything that you're asking me to do on the ground now with weight on my back. And I've felt horses just not have the strength in their back, you know, to really do a whole lot. So rather than doing lots of turns and tight bends and things like that, do lots of kind of lengthening. Have that horse just go for a walk and move freely. You know, let her head drop down and get comfortable so that she looks like she's just, you know, walking across the pasture. Just help her build her confidence to go forwards. You know, a lot of times when we're doing you know, early development on the horse, we tend to think, oh, well, we got to slow him, we got to bend him, we got to, you know, do a lot of turning and things like that, because that may be where we started developing our skills and abilities, you know, and developing our horsemanship on mature horses. So we don't always know that when we're developing younger horses that don't have the same physiology, that sometimes the things that we learn to ask of our mature-bodied horses are kind of a little too difficult for our young ones or less developed, you know, horses. So just letting her enjoy the ride, you know, just let her go, just let her follow along, just have her have, you know, nothing but positive experiences, you know, under the saddle, and her top line will get stronger and stronger just at a walk, you know, just going for a walk down the road with a couple other horses. She gets to go out, enjoy the day. She says, hey, you know, this is kind of a good deal. But if we get on them and kind of, you know, do lots of tight things and lots of bending and lots of turns and disengage the hindquarters, you know, we do kind of, it kind of tips it out of balance a little bit. And we don't always realize that, you know, that horses just need to have a pleasant experience to any new activity that we're asking of them. So, you know, kind of think of it sometimes, you know, from that young horse's point of view is that, okay, if you were developing that relationship with the horse, what you really want to do is to be able to just go down the road safely, be able to bend them down to a stop, be able to take away the hindquarters if you feel a behavior that, you know, you need to take control of. But really, for the most part, you're just really going, in the early stages, just go on a loose rein. Just have that horse enjoy developing their physiology, developing their strength, and feeling what that feels like to kind of recalibrate. A horse has to completely recalibrate their physiology to carry the weight of the saddle, the dead weight of the saddle, and the live weight of the rider. So there's a lot going on there. People think, oh gosh, there's Karen, you know, riding a young horse. She's not doing much with it, you know. And actually, from the horse's point of view, there's a lot going on there. So remember this. You know, horses have different stages of development. You're in the teaching stage, reinforcing stage, and the refining stage. So just take your time. I mean, that's what horsemanship is all about, is just enjoying the journey with the horse. We know where we want it to get to, but take the horse kind of for where it's at right now, you know, in this stage of its development and on this day, and just go, okay, can I take what the horse is giving me and just get it a little better? And sometimes, you know, a lot of times I'm talking in the teleseminars about raising our expectations of horses. But sometimes it's going, okay, I know I can see where I want this to go ultimately, but where's the horse at right now, and where can I just take it one step closer to that, you know? So sometimes it's about backing off a little bit and going, okay, you know, it's never want to do anything that takes the enjoyment of the horse's interaction away. So sometimes it's just backing off, and it's not giving in. Some people go, oh, well, you're giving in to the horse. The horse is being stubborn. The horse is da-da-da. You know, in the other scenario, like the horse weaving, I talk about you making the decisions. In this scenario, I'm still making the decision, but I may be making a decision to just back off and not put so much pressure on the horse and allow that horse to develop that physiology so that it can be physically comfortable of what I'm asking it to do before I start asking for, you know, more demand on their physiology. You know, I want that horse to feel comfortable and confident in everything I'm asking it to do. So, and right now, from the behavior that you're describing, it sounds like it's something in the physiology. And if you don't find it in the teeth, or in the spinal process of the back, if you have a chiropractor or vet, take a look at the horse and do a physical assessment, you know, make sure everything's good there, then I would say that maybe it's just kind of being asked kind of too much in the beginning. You know, it just sometimes just back off, let that horse just go on a relaxed frame and just develop that enjoyment of carrying the rider. And then you can start picking up, you know, pick up and hold it a little bit, ask for a little bit of a bend, you know, move a shoulder, move hindquarters, and then drop it again and have the horse go on. So forward motion, sometimes we don't realize that some horses need to develop that desire to go forward when we kind of do too much of the kind of compact, tight turning stuff, you know, in the beginning. So, and that kind of goes for round pens. You know, people ride a lot of round pens nowadays, and then the horse has trouble, you know, going anywhere because they're so tight, everything's so balled up from never really, you know, covering any ground. So, you know, be sure that you're doing lots of straight lines, just, you know, go and you know, just enjoy the cool part of the day going down the road and really just make things much more enjoyable for both you and the horse. But try those things and see if you don't get an attitudinal change from the horse because we're listening to her and trying to respond to what's going to make the experience and the interaction more enjoyable for her, both mentally and physically for her.
Well, that's a lot to think about and to explore. So So, Lynn, we'd love to hear from you if you find out what it is that can help this horse and you have more fun. The last question tonight is entitled Bit or Rope Halter. Hello, Karen. I have a nice 6-year-old quarter horse for trail riding and pleasure. He was trained using a broken bit with a shank, but always seemed a little unhappy when turning right or left. His teeth have been floated, and all seems well with his mouth. I've begun using a snaffle bit, but he still is not happy when moving in any direction. I think I need to take him off the bit and just use a rope halter for now. What are your thoughts? Also, do you have a Bosal that you recommend? Thanks so much, Erin.
Okay. Well, you know, it's kind of that's a big. Okay, we got 15 minutes. I think I can cover it. It's a big question. You know, it's a big question. And the first thing I'd like to say is that, you know, every horse is an individual. So when I answer questions like this, I want to kind of put that piece out there because, you know, people will go out and say, well, you know, I heard this on the teleseminar and, you know, this is what I'm doing, but it's not working. So, you know, each horse is an individual, so you have to use your own judgment in those scenarios. But I'll give you a little bit of background on the tools. So there's basically three categories of headgear with horses. And they're hackamores, okay? Hackamores mean bitless. It means there's nothing inside the mouth, okay? Hackamores, and then there's snaffle bits, and then there are shank bits, okay? That's it. There's three categories, okay? Unless you ride with a string in the mouth, I'm not sure, you know, what category that fits into, because that's certainly another way to ride. Or bridleless, I guess that's another one. So with a hackamore, it comes from the word hakima, which means a bitless bridle. So that can have different materials. And mechanical hackamores, most people have seen mechanical hackamores, those are shank. They're not a bit. They're called a hackamore, but they have long shanks usually, and they are leverage. Okay, so they actually fall in the category of leverage or shank, even though it doesn't have a bit. Okay, but a true hackamore can be made out of different materials. There can be, and it just means something that directs the outside of the nose. Okay, so that can be made out of rope material. It can be made out of, I've seen it made out of bicycle chain and called a mule hackamore, okay, which is unnecessary, but I've seen it. It can be made out of rawhide, and so any kind of material you can imagine. If it's on the outside of the animal's nose, it's considered a hackamore. So when you talk about a rope halter, that's a hackamore. Okay. When you start changing what the material of the nose piece is, then say you go to rawhide material, then that's called a Bosal. Okay. And there's totally different. All Bosals are not made the same. That's like saying every, you know, shoe in the world is made the same. It's a shoe, okay, but I'll tell you what, as I get older, my shoes get more expensive because I learn the value of, you know, a quality shoe. So, you know, diameter is different, how it's made is different. You know, rawhide can be very rigid on a horse's nose. It can rub a horse's nose. People think, oh, well, it's, you know, it looks really soft and smooth, almost kind of like, you know, reptile skin. And it can be, but in the wrong hands, Bosal can cause a horse to become, to push through it, become very defensive. There's a lot of feel that's put on a rawhide Bosal. So it can be in the wrong hands. So in any of these scenarios, it's not the device so much as it is the person handling it. Okay, the device contributes to it. Okay, because somebody that has really good feel with a horse or a mule or, you know, whatever, wouldn't really gravitate towards a you know, bicycle chain material naturally. But it doesn't mean that somebody comes up and says, oh, well, this is a rawhide Bosal and You know, it's made of soft kangaroo hide or deer skin or something like that, and this won't be uncomfortable for your horse. Well, depending on the person's hand, it can do that. So my preference when I'm developing a horse, when I'm in the developing stage, is to start with something that if the horse becomes confused and a horse pushes into the pressure, I'm only going to deliver so many ounces of pressure. And the horse has the opportunity to follow that, okay, get back into the comfort. My hands, you know, I develop that feel to where it's not the pressure that communicates to the horse, it's the pressure that causes the horse to want to find the release of the pressure. So doing that from up on a horse's back when we're in motion, a straddle, a 1,200-pound prey animal, you know, that takes, you know, time to develop that skill. But when you have that skill, what I do is I like to think of, okay, I have a young horse here. I've done all my foundation on the ground. I've taught that horse to, you know, young horses, they'll just follow the weight of the rope. When I pick up the rope and I put that feel, they don't sit there and go, well, she's not pulling hard enough to turn my nose. These young horses that never learn to pull on a person, you know, that's my ideal, is that a horse never finds out that he ever has the need or the desire or the ability to pull on the human needs. Now, I've never given him a reason to pull on me. Okay, that's ideal. But most horses have been around people that we just, you know, have been handled with people who don't understand that the horse has such a high intelligence level and high sensitivity that they seek that comfort. And somehow they're so big. You know, that's probably one of the most common things I see with people is, I think because they're 1,200 pounds, that we think, well, they have to put a lot of pressure on them to move that big, massive body weight. And yet a little tiny fly or mosquitoes can pester horses enough to, you know, have them do just about anything. You know, we had a rooster that would sit on the fence, and he thought it was really, you know, fun to move the horses around just by flapping his wings. So, you know, they really don't take a lot of pressure to do that. So what I like to do is I start with a rope halter. And that way, if I offer that feel and the horse becomes confused in any way and the horse pushes against it, I can hold there. I can hold there, and it's not going to cause any pain. It's going to be uncomfortable because it's a very specific material that I use, where the placement of the two knots, you know, on the nose are, is that if a horse pulled into it, it'll roll across the facial nerve. But the instant the horse follows the feel and gets back into the middle of that halter, there's a release of that, and there's no knot sitting on top of that facial nerve. So the horse learns that where the comfort is, and it values the comfort. That's all that does. It doesn't cause pain. It's just enough discomfort for the horse to value the comfort, if that makes sense. Anything that is designed for pain, it interferes with the learning process with the horse. So I see all kinds of things. I've seen, you know, cable embedded in the noseband. I've seen, you know, extra knots across the noseband. I've seen climbing rope rather than yachting braid, you know, because it's very rigid. And I've seen, you know, the hair on the horse's nose, you know, rub off, you know, really pretty quick because it's so abrasive. So when you're looking at material, you know, but it can be too soft as well. I have the folks that make my products specifically to my, you know, specifics. They keep saying, oh, we have these different colors, and we have all these, everybody wants different colors, and we want purple and gold and all this. But the material that comes in those colors is too flimsy. So it's like overcooked spaghetti. And that creates a problem because if I need to scoop up a horse's nose, I've got to hold that nose band open, and it just changes the feel of the material. The whole feel of that to that horse, you know, changes. So it's very specific how the material should feel. I'm always talking kind of like Goldilocks, not too firm, not too soft, kind of just right. So when people kind of hear those little bits of how specific these materials are designed, I encourage people to go on the website. I have the explanation of how it's designed. If you want to make this kind of material to these specifications, I tell you how to do it. Go ahead and knock yourself out. Go ahead and do it. But I'll tell you what, it's a heck of a lot easier just to buy it, you know, and buy the right stuff the first time. And that's another piece I'll mention. I say this in the teleseminars, you know, every so often. It doesn't take long to be in the horse industry to realize that cheap is not cheap. So, you know, we buy inexpensive things because we're not sure that that's what we really want. And then we go, oh, okay, well, that broke or it didn't work. And we go, okay, now I know what I don't want. And you look for something else. So, you know, you can do that. I did that, you know, when I got into horses. And I had the pile of material that, you know, didn't work for, you know, a lot of different reasons. But then it made me hesitant to get anything. And so that's why I put together the things that, you know, are my preferences from, you know, not just the things I've invented, but people that I've been around and I ask them these questions. And, you know, they've had horses for decades and what do they use and why do they use it. And some things I agree and I value and some things I go, you know, I don't know that that'll work for me. But I've had so many experiences where people just ride in the halter and lead or ride with a rope hackamore, and they go, you know what, I don't even know why I need anything else. You know, I'm getting along so well. You know, the gal up in Oregon that just, her husband gave her the ultimatum and said, you know, me or the horse, wouldn't even allow the horse to live on their property. This horse was so extreme, great big, beautiful red, you know, thoroughbred horse. And, you know, he was just full of himself. He was so strong and so powerful. But the thing that she did is she went, you know what, instead of doing more, she had every contraption, you know, available in every tack store, and she just said, nothing is working. And I said, you know what, we need to find a way to influence his mind. And she got to where it didn't take very long. Once she reached his mind and his heart, and he said, boy, you know, I've been trying to tell you that this stuff is not going to work for me. When she stepped back and said, I'm going to take a totally different approach with tools designed for communication, she started being able to have a conversation with the horse. And she would ride, and she said, Karen, I'll ride any trail in the country on this horse with that rope hackamore. She said, I feel that confident and that safe. He's so relaxed. He has nothing scares him. Deer jump out. But she says, we see every kind of thing up here in Oregon. And she said, I feel, you know, you can't eliminate, you know, all the risk. But she said, I feel 100 times safer than I did in all the kind of gadgets and gadgets I had before. Okay? So when you're developing the communication with a horse and developing the confidence, I would highly recommend using a tool that is as soft as possible, but it's just uncomfortable enough that the horse, it discourages the horse from pulling on the human. The next stage I like to move into is just a simple snaffle bit. Now, here's the other thing. All snaffle bits are not created equal. Okay, so I have a very specific snaffle bit, and a snaffle bit does not mean a broken mouthpiece. A lot of people think that that's what makes it a snaffle bit, but driving bits are snaffle bits, and they're a solid mouthpiece. Okay, a snaffle bit simply means that there's no leverage, so it's a one-to-one ratio of pressure to feel. So all that means is if I have 1 pound of pressure in my right hand, the horse feels 1 pound of pressure on the right side of the bit. Okay, so it's a one-to-one ratio. So that's all that means. And it's designed to be used more laterally. So when I'm turning the horse or bending the horse or disengaging the hindquarters, when I'm doing lots of suppling type of activity. But a horse will learn to pick up. And this is the thing to note, too, is that a snaffle bit in the wrong hands can be one of the cruelest bits in the world. Because if you're in the habit of pulling on two reins, then what happens is that mouthpiece hinges in the middle, and it forms one of the steepest, sharpest ports that you can imagine. And it's not uncommon to see horses where, you know, people have them, you know, reined in, and that horse is sticking his nose, trying to stick his nose straight, opening his mouth to avoid that pointy part, that sharp part that the mouthpiece is forming. So, you know, it's important to understand that, and then the horse is sticking his nose straight out, and so people go, well, you got to, you know, put a tie down on him, and then he's gaping his mouth. And then people say, well, you got to, you know, put a noseband on him and keep his mouth shut so we can go into the show. And what we don't realize is that you develop a horse to be comfortable with a bit, you know, and you do lots of lateral to help them find that suppleness in their neck and in their throughout their back through their entire spinal process, just like we were talking about with the last horse. You develop that over time. And then you can pick up, you know, if you go online and look at some of the riding photos, you know, with one of my horses, Bergante, you'll see that I have him very collected in a snaffle bit. But what I do is I pick up my reins, and what he knows is that when his head, when he kind of picks up with me, it feels like I'm holding his hand. It doesn't feel like I'm, you know, wrenching his head back, you know, put your head in and down, you know, it's nothing like that. I'm just picking him up to hold a conversation, and then he brings his head back to make the mouthpiece straight in his mouth again, see? But we're not taught to have that kind of, you know, develop that kind of feel in the beginning. You know, that's something that you develop over many, many years. But I want to give you that idea of that's what a snaffle bit is about. A snaffle bit is for lateral, okay, side-to-side type of communication because it keeps that mouthpiece straight. You don't want to put your horse in a situation where that kind of mouthpiece becomes, you know, uncomfortable inside of their mouth. So then we get to the leverage bits or the shank bits. And any time you add a shank down off the bottom of a bit, you add leverage. And all that means is, depending on the length of the lever, is it's not a one-to-one ratio anymore. So you could have a broken mouthpiece with a short shank on it. A lot of people call that a training bit or a Tom Thumb bit. There's all kinds of names for every kind of thing. But basically what that means is that when you have 1 pound of pressure, depending on the length of that shank, the horse is going to feel, you know, twice that or maybe more. So, you know, you can have a short 1 or 2 inch shank and you feel 1 pound and you go, oh, gee, well, my hands are really light, but he's fighting me and he's uncomfortable. Well, he says, well, you know what, it feels like 5 pounds, 7 pounds to me, maybe 10, maybe 20, okay? So until somebody explains that, we start going, well, you know, it seems like a good bit and somebody told me it was a good bit. You know, other people use this bit and their horse seems fine. You know, but this horse is not. So what I like to do when I'm, you know, helping a horse is just go back to those basics. Go back to the ground. Go back to that halter and lead. And just on the ground, just have your horse lateral flexion. You know, set up a set of reins and just from the ground. See if you can pick them up and steer them. Create some drive lines, you know, where you can just have that horse without the weight on the back. Can I develop the feel in my hands without my seat or legs getting involved, okay? So, like, you know, if you use the example of, like, Spanish riding school, you know, you teach first, everything is first taught on the ground. So you train your hands isolated from your seat and your legs. Then you teach your seat and legs while the teacher has the drive lines in their hands. So that's another isolation. And I don't know if this is true, but I have heard, you know, over the years that a student that goes to the Spanish riding school will spend 2 years doing those kinds of isolations before they ever are on the back of the horse with the reins in their hand, see? And we get out there and we go, well, you know, I'm not training the horse unless I'm riding. I'm using my leg and my seat and my hands and my voice and my, what should I do? You know, and it all becomes so confusing. What we're really doing is not developing the horse, but we're developing our ability to solicit a behavior from the horse, okay? The horse is the power, okay? But the first communication to that horse isn't through our physiology. The things that we're doing in our physiology are to tap into the mind of the horse. If I can influence the mind of the horse, you know, everybody says, well, I want to control the body, okay? Well, you know what? You're outweighed, you're outpowered, you're, you know, you'll fight that forever. But if you learn to influence the mind of the horse by understanding it's the release that teaches, then you start using your tools in a different way. You know, I'll pick up a lead rope, and I'll feel that horse feeling me. Okay, that's a special feeling. But, you know, a lot of times we just pick up the rope and we're not mindful. We just think, well, I'm just leading the horse from point A to point B. And most people are, you know, and they get along okay. And horses are, they're wonderful creatures. They go along and they go, okay. But believe me, there's so much more that we can do, you know, for our horses through education, through practice, through trial and error, you know. And the greatest thing is you can go out there and you get do-overs. You just go, man, I don't know how I went to here, but I listened to this teleseminar last night, and I'm just going to take a fresh start and rebuild this. And I think you'll be really amazed at how quickly that horse responds to a little bit different approach. I really want to commend you for a great question, because it's a really common thing for people to have that kind of confusion. Now, let me just add one more piece. There's nothing wrong with leverage bits. There's nothing wrong with them. They're just for a different purpose. They're for the purpose of a finished horse. When you want a horse to find collection, okay, then you use a shank bit, because you don't use more pressure, you use less pressure. It becomes subtle, okay? So it's kind of like when, you know, ballroom dancers, they, you know, dance in high heels for this refined arch. It gives them a different posture to perform the maneuvers that they're doing, to the eye appeal, you know, of the judges or competition and things like that. So it's a refinement in the tools, okay? So there's nothing wrong with leverage, but it's developing the person's ability to have the kind of feel that that horse needs to be able to bring out that horse's best, okay? So that's kind of everything in a, I didn't quite make it in 15 minutes, but I tried. But we're developing, you know, more education on this perspective on bits, because I think this broad perspective, and there's so much more to learn. I mean, there's dozens of books out there, and there's incredibly knowledgeable people about, you know, how the mechanics of the mouth affects the physiology through the TMJ. I mean, it can be become, you know, it's scientific. But if you just think about how do I tap into the mental and emotional state of the horse, a horse that is collected, truly collected, is not only physically collected, but mentally and emotionally collected. So a horse that has, you know, devices on it to keep his head in and down and keep his mouth shut and his foaming and dripping out of the mouth, in my opinion, it's just not necessary. You know, my experience has been, you know, there's another way to go about that. And, but, you know, it's not to criticize or fault anyone. It just doesn't need to be that way in my experience. But to me, that horse may be physically collected, but not mentally and emotionally collected. And to me, if you don't have true collection without all of them combined, equally combined together, okay? So that gives you my 20 minutes on bits, but go back to the beginning and then just kind of step through it and always be thinking about, you know, how can I help this horse understand what it is that I'm asking them to do? Okay, and then just kind of trust your gut on things and try things. There's a bit that I sell, one bit on my website. Believe me, you know, the bit's not out there paying the bills. It's one Snaffle bit. It's very difficult to find. You can find them in tack stores like Brighton Feed up in Brighton, Colorado, but I have not found it in another tack store. I think that there was one other tack store in Central California that carried it. But it is a sweet iron Snaffle, and sweet iron is really important. See, you guys thought I was done in 20 minutes. Sweet iron is very important because it rusts. When it oxidizes, it creates a really nice flavor for the horse. Okay, it has a tiny bit of copper in it, which isn't allowed in some dressage competitions, but there is a version without copper in it if people have that requirement. But it's a loose ring Snaffle, and again, you can go on my website and see the specifics and why I use that specifically. But I've looked for another Snaffle that I think has more features to it and the horse likes better. I haven't found it. It needs to be a certain weight, a certain shape. Loose ring has a certain purpose to it, all of those things. So that'd take another 30 minutes to go into that, so I won't do that here. But please, just know, if I carry something on my website, it's because it's a piece of equipment that really, truly makes a difference in the communication with a horse, and usually it's something that's kind of difficult to find. Things that are easy to find, I don't carry them because, you know, holding inventory and shipping and that kind of thing, if you can get it at the tax store, then, you know, I'll say, hey, go to your local tax store and get that. But if things are kind of hard to find or very specific in how they're made, I either have them made, you know, to my specifications, or I carry a specific item that is a really great general use tool for most people. When it's stainless steel, all that means is that it doesn't rust anymore. The metal is not live anymore, and it doesn't have as nice taste to it to horses. Okay, so that's kind of the difference between sweet iron. Snaffle, and anybody who's been, you know, had horses in a pasture with a rusty pipe, you know, holding up a, you know, part of the fence or something, you'll see horses go out there and just lick on a rusty pipe. They just really enjoy the flavor of it. So something to think of. Copper material is too soft. I have actually been around a horse that had pink foam coming out of its mouth on a ride, and the owner had got this brand new bit, and it was mostly copper, and the horse had got it in its teeth and sharpened it down, and it was actually making little cuts on the side of the tongue and the corner of the lip. You know, during the ride, he pulled the bit out, and I looked at this bit, and it was just razor sharp, and I said, why did you get a bit like that? He goes, it wasn't like that when I put it in, you know, not even realizing, you know, that copper's that soft that it would do something like that. So, you know, be really aware of the materials and see how that goes for you. Just go back and, you know, just kind of rebuild that communication with your horse. I think that everything will go really, really well for you and your horse. And eventually, you know, reintroduce a bit. Just let your horse just wear it. Don't use it. Just put it on underneath the rope halter without any reins on it and just have your horse carry it for a while and just get comfortable picking it up and holding it in its mouth. It's not going to cause any pain or pressure to him. So you can rebuild a horse's confidence using a bit. Okay?
Wow, Karen, that's obviously a huge subject. And thanks for taking the time to give us the basics. And just know that there's a lot more to know about bits and psychology of using them.
Yeah. There's a whole lot to it.
Yeah. In closing, I'd just like to mention that in October you have a couple of events coming up. You're doing a workshop in Grand Junction, Colorado. It's a 3-day event where people can bring their horse and get hands-on help with you over those 3 days. You'll also be in outside of Toronto, Canada, for another 3-day clinic in October. And you will be presenting at the main event expo in British Columbia. So there's
an
opportunity for people to see you in October.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I always enjoy my trips to Canada, and this will be I've been to Canada multiple times. It'll be my first time in British Columbia. So, no, that's not right. Yeah, it is. Been to Alberta. But, yeah, this will be the first time. So I'm looking forward to meeting the West Coasters.
That's great. And then if you're interested in bringing your horse to a clinic, get online. There's information there. Give us a call. We'd be happy to help you with that. And there's always the opportunity to fly in. If we're not in your area, fly to one of these clinics and audit. Or we could help you see if there's a horse that locally that you might be able to lease for the weekend.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, people are doing because I've just had to back off my schedule so much, you know, this last year, is that it's getting more and more common that people are flying in. The facility in Grand Junction has some lovely horses there. And people sometimes think, well, if I can't bring my horse, then, you know, what's the point? And every single time, you know, people fly in and they get a hotel and they're kind of nervous and they meet the horse they're going to use for the weekend, and then they go, this is so valuable, because it kind of takes that dynamic of familiarity away, and all of a sudden you're really able to focus on what you're doing And sometimes when we have our own horses, we tend to think, oh, well, that's how he is. You know, this is, he did that when he was a young horse. You know, we have kind of the story behind it. And you get a different dance partner out there, and all of a sudden you start going, you develop that awareness of, you know, how are you coming across? What are your skills? And the wonderful thing about muscle memory is you take that skill you develop with that horse for the weekend, and you take it home, and your horse at home goes, wow, where have you been? You know, you're different. I like it. So it's really effective. And people don't always, you know, consider doing that. And they kind of, you know, sit at home and go, well, I have to wait till Karen gets to, you know, South Florida, you know. And you know, it may not happen. I've had people say, well, I'll wait till you come here. And I kind of put it out there, you know, my DVDs have gone all over the world. You know, there's people in South Africa, England, you know, Australia, New Zealand. And, you know, you think I'm going to be able to get to South Africa quite a bit, you know. And they go, well, no, of course not. I go, well, people in their horses need help there too. So the reality of it is that there's DVDs, you know, to study from and start, you know, making that change, you know, making that shift and that change with the communication with your horse, and then get the hands-on help, you know, get to an event or get to a clinic, or, you know, consider, people say, well, you know, Karen's not doing many clinics here this year, you know, changing her schedule, but anything's possible. Don't feel like, oh, well, you know, she's not on the schedule, it has never come to, you know, Texas, for example. I've never taught a clinic in Texas. And, you know, but it doesn't mean I won't. So, you know, possibilities are always there.
All right. Thank you, Karen, for taking the time to answer our questions tonight. And thanks, everyone, who sent your question in. If we didn't get to it this month, we'll see if we can get to it next month. In the meantime, keep sending them in or go to our website and listen to answers from previous questions from previous months. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Karen, and we'll just see you next month. Good night.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Good night.